Hello and welcome to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson. Joining me shortly will be Tim Phillips, and we tackle this week's review. I had originally planned a kind of a different opening for this week's show because I thought the Golden Globes were this past Sunday, and it turns out that they are this coming Sunday. So that was, well, a relatively minor hiccup on my account. Sorry, best laid plans and all that. We'll have to wait until next weekend to find out who's won various Golden Globes and things, and then I will be able to discuss that. In the meantime, I had to come up with an entirely new plan for this first part of the show on the fly. Will I succeed? Well, I guess we will wait and see. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We are here every Wednesday at 3 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new personal drama Sound of Metal, which you can now stream on premium VOD services like Apple TV, Google Play, and the Cineplex store. So, in lieu of talking about the Golden Globes, which again have not yet happened, I have scoured the internets for some movie news. And it's been a pretty active couple of days in movie news in the last week or so. I guess it's last week when, well, it's the last time we did a movie news segment. I want to talk about some of the trailers I watched, but before I get to that, there was an interesting article in the Hollywood Reporter. Sorry, I look through my notes as I'm talking, so if I stop, this is the great thing about open sources, is if I'm looking through my notes, Scotty can talk, and then I can find the things in my notes anyway. When it's just me, I have to pause, because I'm trying to read and talk at the same time, which is easier said than done. Anyway, the Hollywood Reporter had an article after last weekend about how Searchlight Pictures was not releasing any box office information about No Man's Land. Now, this is, I'd like to say this is unusual, but it's becoming less and less unusual as time goes on. But No Man's Land is, well, first of all, No Man's Land isn't coming out till March. It's going to be released in some theaters in March, and then it's going to be available in as many theaters as are open to take it come April. Plus, it will be available on Disney Plus, the Star Channel on Disney Plus, which is a new channel on the Disney Plus app that is going to, I guess, more adult fare, and I don't mean like triple X, I mean like things that do not fit comfortably on the Disney Plus channel, which skewers towards mostly family-friendly things. But No Man's Land is kind of Searchlight's big Oscar push. The film they're kind of putting their heft behind. Of course, Searchlight is now owned by Disney. It used to be owned by News Corp because it was Fox Searchlight. Now it's Searchlight Pictures owned by Disney. And it's kind of concerning because this is, like, again, their big release, their big, and normally you want to, in the interest of transparency, the box office numbers are usually numbers that come out every Sunday afternoon, and then confirm Monday morning, because the Sunday afternoon releases are just estimates, because it doesn't take into account all of Sunday. But this is kind of like typically been a barometer about success, not just success of a singular film, but success of the theatrical business on a whole. If it was a really good weekend where you had, a new release make $100 million, and then you had like the second, third, and fourth place movies make a combined $100 million, and then the fifth place, I mean, you know, when it all adds up, if you had like a $300, $400 million weekend, that was a really, really good weekend. Obviously, that's not the case these days because of COVID-19, and in a lot of the big places, like Toronto, for instance, Toronto right now, movie theaters are not open. Toronto is still technically in lockdown, and so are in places in like Peel, which are also big areas that are fairly populous. And, you know, I'm thinking about places like the Square One. I can't remember the name of the theater at Square One, but I mean, it also shows a lot of like Indian movies. because of, you know, there's a fairly large Indian population in that area. So it imports a lot of these movies from that they think local audiences would enjoy from their homeland. But yeah, so the concerning part is that more these numbers are being more and more covered up, not covered up in sort of like that, like it's a plot, but in terms of like, they're very concerned about how this looks, because you have movies that are opening with like $2 or $3 million, and in pre-COVID days, that would be considered a gross, terrible failure. I mean, I think Tenet, when it came out, made like $150 million domestically. If Tenet makes $150 million domestically, pre-COVID, that would be more or less a failure. But I mean, in current COVID terms, post-COVID terms, if you like, that is, I think, a tremendous success. But in that, in so much as we got numbers about Tenet and other Warner Brothers films that have technically been released in theaters, but are more or less have been watched online, like The Little Things and Judas and the Black Messiah, which we released last week, instead of releasing the numbers from a service called ComScore, which is kind of like a real-time update of the theatrical numbers, Warner Brothers has not been releasing their ComScore stats. They've been releasing stats more directly from them. And so there's, not to use the word cover-up again, but that is kind of essentially what's happened. They are covering up these box office numbers because, more likely than not, they don't want to look bad if you know, oh, our movie made $1 million this weekend, which should technically be a cause for celebration again because so many movie theaters are closed. But they are taking it as a sign. And of course, there's been an issue the last couple of years. Netflix and Amazon, well, Amazon not so much, but Netflix has been very cagey about releasing stats and numbers, or the number of people who've watched you know, movies that they've released on their platform. Things like the limited theatrical run for the movies they do, you know, those typically do get released. But Netflix doesn't say, this weekend, so many people watched Mank, so many people watched To All the Boys I Loved Before, so many people watched The Irishman, and things like that. They will do that if it's, if they're trying to frame it as like exceptionally good news. Like I can't remember when Bright came out, but it was like it was something like a quarter of the houses in that subscribe to Netflix in America watched Bright this weekend. And you know, box office analysts are kind of forced, well, what would that look like in terms of box office numbers if like that number of people times the average price of a movie ticket, it would make X amount of dollars at the box office. And that gives you kind of some idea about just how successful a movie might be in practical terms. But again, we don't know because Netflix isn't releasing hard data about what their numbers are like. So it's fairly concerning. Right now you have basically two studios that are releasing at least unmolested numbers, and they're kind of the bottom two studios because it's Sony and Paramount. No, actually, it's Universal and Paramount. Sorry, Sony is actually not releasing their ComScore numbers at all. Warner Brothers are releasing a variation of those numbers, but it's kind of really, in terms of like doing like really hardcore analysis on, you know, judging the success or failure of certain films, it's not a great time because that information is just not readily available. And actually, it looks like studios are doing all they can to make sure that that information is not relatively readily available. That's what I was thinking about. Anyway, in other news, Brett Ratner announced his comeback this weekend. He, you know, you may know Brett Ratner as the director of the Rush Hour movies and X-Men Last Stand and the remake of Red Dragon. I don't know what he's done. Actually, his last film before that was before being deplatformed because of Me Too was one of the Hercules movies. I can't remember which Hercules movie it was, if it was the one starring The Rock or the one starring one of the hot boys from Twilight. I can't recall. Anyway, he has announced his comeback, a biopic of Milli Vanilli. And this immediately got the attention of Me Too advocates, Time's Up advocates, who make the point that Brent Ratner really hasn't done the hard work of apologizing or trying to make amends in some way, shape, or form for the things that got him deplatformed in the first place. I was kind of reminded of Mark Halperin, who was the co-author of the two Game Change books and was a fairly well-known author and political analyst. He had some Me Too-style allegations against him. He went away, and then he tried to come back. I think it was immediately before the U.S. election. He tried to release a book, and he got dinged in a similar fashion. It's like, well, dude, before you release a new book, maybe you should go back and, like, I don't know, apologize to your victims. And to my knowledge, he did not do that, but he did go back to going away. And it remains to be seen if a similar thing will happen about Brett Ratner. His company, Rat Pack Productions, also had a hand in funding a lot of the DC movies. And when the Me Too allegations came out against him in 2017, Gal Gadot was one of the people who said, like, well, I'm not going to work with him again. And since she's Wonder Woman, that was that for Brett Ratner's involvement with funding the DC movies. So, moving right along, speaking of creepy allegations, the first episode of Allen vs. Pharaoh aired on HBO last weekend, and it tells the story from the point of view of Mia Farrow and her daughter Dylan Farrow about Woody Allen's alleged abuse of her when she was a young girl, and it is it's a harrowing and difficult and creepy watch. I don't think I've been creeped out that hard since the Michael Jackson doc a couple of years ago. But Woody Allen and his current wife, who was once his girlfriend's adopted daughter, well, I guess she still is, released a statement that said that it was a hatchet job and riddled with falsehoods is another phrase that came out of that. And I just got to say, you know, I'm not sure that's the point at this point. I think it's one of the things that strikes me, that struck me watching the first part of that documentary was just sort of how long those allegations persisted against Woody Allen, and people kept kind of working with him, like for 20 years after those allegations first sort of came to the surface. He enjoyed still a lengthy career in Hollywood, and also one where he was awarded with Oscars and things, or at the very least Oscar nominations, and his movies were being awarded with Oscar nominations. Cate Blanchett won an Oscar for one of his movies, Blue Jasmine. Let's just say Woody Allen is not coming back. And an interesting side note to this, the publisher of his memoir, because there are excerpts from the audiobook used in the documentary, are now threatening to sue HBO and the producers, for not getting proper clearances, I guess. I guess there's no account for fair game on that part. Trailers. I wanted to talk about trailers, and I guess I'll have to be super brief now. They released the trailer for Cruella, which I hate myself for liking. It is the, I guess, prequel to 101 Dalmatians. It's one of these movies where Disney's recycling its villains and stories, and I mean, I remember a couple of weeks ago when we talked about the films of 1996, the live-action remake of 101 Dalmatians came out in 1996, and here we are with the live-action prequel starring Emma Stone as Cruella de Vil, who's like a disgraced fashion designer who becomes a supervillain. I hope there's, because the movie looks great, Emma Stone looks great, and sounds great, and generally is great. But I hope there is more to this, like maybe from the Maleficent angle, the first Maleficent movie, not necessarily the second Maleficent movie, where it's, they're going to try and massage the character a bit and try and do something new and interesting rather than just being a straight-up supervillain origin, which kind of bores me. But having said that, I enjoyed the trailer and I hate myself for it. There was also a trailer for Mortal Kombat, which is the new version of Mortal Kombat, which is being produced by James Wan, so I have a lot of expectations for it. I think, I don't know if there was a green band trailer, because if this was a red band trailer, because it's super gory, including one scene where Sub-Zero freezes a guy's arms and rips them off. But I mean, it gave me everything I wanted. The voice for Sub-Zero, and there's a scene in the trailer that goes, "I am Sub-Zero," and that voice is perfect. There's a scene where the guy playing Kano says, "Kano wins," which is, again, like, right out of the video game. Like, get over here and finish. Like, it checked all the Mortal Kombat boxes. And I will stand by this, too. Like, the original Mortal Kombat movie from Paul W.S. Anderson is probably the gold standard for how you adapt a video game into a movie property, because it just doesn't overthink it. So I hope that with the tech, I think the tech is the big thing, because a proper budget, a properly budgeted Mortal Kombat could be excellent. And that comes out in April. Cruella comes out in May. Before that, though, I did want to draw attention to this trailer for Happily, which is about a married couple played by Joel McHale and Carrie Bish. And apparently they are too happy as a married couple and too in love with each other and still so passionate about one another that it is a community offense, and it is about why they, you know, how people get bored in a marriage, I guess, and how passion dwindles. And it's a comedy, and it sounds really good, and I enjoyed the trailer. I do hope it's not like a situation like Ike Barinholtz's The Oath, where it's like a really great idea that ultimately does not pay off as well as it should. Anyway, that's it for trailers this week. That's it for news. We're going to get into the review in a sec. We are going to bid adieu to Black Heritage Month with a little Black Cadmium. This is from their EP, Muted Chaos. And this is the End Credits Show. You're listening to End Credits on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio. And that was a clip from Sound of Metal. It's the new film from Darius Marder, and it stars Riz Ahmed, Olivia Cooke, Paul Racy, Chelsea Lee, Lauren Ridloff, and Matthew Almerich. I am now being joined on the line by Tim Phillips. Tim, how are you today?
Doing well. Looking forward to getting some warmer weather, but enjoying the winter weather so far. Might go out, make a snowman, something like that later. How are you doing, Adam?
I'm good. I've not reached snowman level of, pandemic lockdown where anything to get outside, but more power to you, Tim, and maybe some snow angels too. And
that's my plan.
Perfect. You're going for that moment of stillness, perhaps, that was talked about in this week's movie, Sound of Metal. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about trying to get away from downer topics a minute ago before we started recording, but it's kind of a downer when you are a heavy metal drummer and you start to go deaf, and that is the TLDR version of the plot of Sound of Metal. But Tim, why did this movie appeal to you and on your list of things to watch?
Yeah, Adam, it struck me as seemed like a really interesting concept. I just knew the basics about a heavy metal drummer who's starting to lose his hearing, and it looked like a really interesting film. Got really good reviews, and I figured, I'm a fan of music. I'd probably be drawn in by that. But I was pleasantly surprised by a lot more to this film, especially like the deaf community in the film. Really delving deeper into addiction and also this whole community of people at this deaf rehabilitation center, and I thought it was really, really cool. And I knew Riz Ahmed was starring in it, and I've liked him from since I saw him in Nightcrawler. So I was like really interested to see what he was working on, and he's awesome in this. And then I was pleasantly surprised by the supporting performances: Olivia Cooke as his girlfriend and bandmate, and then Paul Racy as the the head counselor at the addiction clinic for deaf people. He's just amazing in this. He has such great presence, and his performance really blew my mind. I thought it was amazing, and I wasn't really expecting that. I was thinking, okay, this will be I thought it might be a movie more about the music, about which there's plenty of music in it, but I thought it'd be more about losing touch with the music, which the lead character does, and he has regrets about it. But it delves a lot deeper into relationships and choices and accepting change. And I thought, it was a really terrific movie. And I had heard very little about it. Saw it on on a streaming service. Watched it and I was like, wow, this is a pretty incredible movie. So I think it's getting quite a lot of awards notice too, so I'm looking forward to that, and I hope it continues to, because I thought it was a real human story. Like you're saying, it is a bit of a downer. So if you're looking for escapist entertainment, I wouldn't flock to this film, but it definitely tells a really interesting story about somebody going through addiction and then that change of losing your hearing so suddenly, which is what happens to the lead character. It's pretty, just really sort of like a freaky experience. And I can only imagine going through that where, one day you feel like you can hear, and then the next day it's like you can only hear like 20% of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
I
think I was concerned going in about, it took me a while to think about, wasn't there another movie about a musician who goes deaf? And I had to actually look it up on Wikipedia, because they have like the way they organize things, there's a category for films about deaf people. And there's actually, it's quite a substantive filmography. But I was thinking specifically of Mr. Holland's Opus, which is this, just super melodramatic movie about a man who dreams of writing the great symphony and has to settle for being a music teacher that inspires everyone for 20 years. And one of the subplots of that movie is that he ends up starting to go deaf, and how he tries to deal with that, because music's such an important part of his life. Music, of course, as you said, is a pretty big part of this film. However, it's part of like a much broader tapestry, because as you said, the Ruben character played by Riz Ahmed is a recovering addict, and you get very much the impression that he discusses in the film how he did a lot of drugs, mostly heroin. He had been in recovery for 4 years. Not coincidentally, I think, is also the time he meets Lou, his girlfriend. Mm-hmm. And they start this this metal band duo together, and they start living this nomadic lifestyle in their Gulfstream, going from gig to gig to gig. And so the film is very much about Ruben finally embracing recovery, because you get the sense that he went from one addiction, which was his, drug addiction, to another addiction, which was this idealized nomadic music existence with his girlfriend and their Gulfstream. And he has the movie is as much about him having trouble letting go of that life as it is about him dealing with his deafness. And there's a very strong sort of addiction allegory there, that he's addicted to his old life and is just, fundamentally unable to give it up, just like a lot of addicts are fundamentally unable to give up their substance dependency until they've reached rock bottom. So, there's a lot of stuff going on with that character, too. And I'm glad you highlighted Paul Racy, because he factors heavily in my notes as well, that, he has such great presence. He is not deaf himself. However, I was reading up on him. His parents were deaf, and he's done a lot of activism for the deaf community and the hearing impaired community. And he's just so great. I hate to say it this way, but he's very real.
Yeah. I really liked him. I was like, wow, I really like this guy, It just seems like this could be almost like a documentary here. It seems like he had that role in life somehow. And it does align with, he had, like you said, deaf parents, so he knows American Sign Language, and he's worked as sort of like an interpreter for his parents for years and for others. And so you can really see that he's really grounded in the role. And even in the role, he says how he lost his hearing as a bomb went off when he was in Vietnam. And mm-hmm. Paul Racy in real life did 2 tours of duty in Vietnam. Wow. So it's definitely a tailor-made role for him. At the same time, I wish I had seen him in stuff before, because he's such a good actor and such great presence. And apparently he's done a lot of theater, and he's done some TV, some movies, but not really a lot of movies. And I think he's just incredible in this, and I'm sure this will get him more work in film for sure.
It could be a case of I did look at his filmography, and I recognize like some of the shows he was on, but I don't recognize him. And so this may be one of those instances where like he's kind of like broken out now. Now you can, when you're watching an old episode of Law and Order that he popped up in. I don't know if he popped up in Law and Order, but just as an example, you're like, oh, there's Paul Racy before he was famous in The Sound of Metal. Yeah. But he brings such a gravitas to it, and he's not humorless, but he's also he's not like jokey. He's strict, but he's not unbendable. And it's a seemingly such a simple performance, but I hate to use the word gravitas again, but you just feel the texture of the things he says. Like there's a line where, or I should say a scene where Ruben is like fixing the eaves, and And yeah. Joe, who's the Paul Racy character, he comes out and he says to him, you know, why don't you come and talk to me? And they go into the office. And he's sitting there, and Ruben's talking about how he needed to fix this thing, and he's trying to stay busy with his hands. And Joe just looks at him and says straight up, "There is nothing here that you need to fix." Mm-hmm. And it's like such a mic drop, and it's just yeah. it's and he doesn't really inflect, he doesn't really like use the exclamation point. He just says it straight up. "There is nothing here that you need to fix." And boom, and the line lands like a ton of bricks, and you can see it on Riz Ahmed's face too. It's just there's something so real to it. Like, this guy has lived it all, he has seen it all. You are not a unique special snowflake to him. He understands exactly what you're doing, and you know, implicit in that too is like, you should listen to me. But it's not a command. It's not a commandment. It's just like, listen to me. There is nothing here that you need to fix.
Yeah, he's got that quiet authority and, like you're saying, the screen presence. And I just thought right now of maybe, like, a completely different movie, but like Robert Forster in Jackie Brown kind of thing. You know, just that natural vibe, but it's just amazing acting at the same time, you know? Yeah. Like, even though he has that experience, he's obviously using that, and that's helping him with the role, but I wouldn't say he's typecast, because I could see him being in other types of roles, just with that sort of that presence about him, that quiet confidence. I think it really comes through well in this film, and it plays really well with the Riz Ahmed character Ruben, who also gives an amazing performance. As someone just desperate to get back to the way things were before this all happened, right? And wants to go to any lengths to get his hearing back, is trying to get an expensive operation, and it's just playing off that with the Paul Racy character Joe, who's saying, you know, it's not a handicap, you know, being deaf. We're living as deaf people here in a community, and there's that amazing sense of community when they're having dinner at the table and they're all talking in American Sign Language. And at first, Ruben doesn't understand. And then Joe writes on the board, everybody has a job, for, you know, and his job is learn how to be deaf, right? And then Ruben, you know, time passes, and then he learns sign language, and then he can interact better with the group, and then he comes to accept it. But still in the back of his mind, because he's been separated now, like, voluntarily from his girlfriend, right? Lou, right? Played by Olivia Cook, and she's gone back home to Paris, and he's like looking her up on the one computer they have in the whole facility there, just checking his email and then seeing what she's up to. And he can't, like you're saying, he's addicted to that lifestyle he had before. It's like he traded one addiction for another, and that's what Joe says, because he just asks really direct questions. He's like, how long have you been an addict? And Ruben says 4 years, and then he's like, how long have you known Lou? And he's like, 4 years, you know. And it's just trading one addiction for another, and it's really interesting to see, and how he can't, how Ruben can't be comfortable, like, in that stillness or with this new group. He can't accept that rapid change that's happened to him. And I find that fascinating. And Riz Ahmed just does an amazing job acting through it, showing the frustration and stubbornness, and, you know, thinking he knows better. Well, and he's got this mentor there for him, Joe, who is really helping him get his life on track, but he can't accept that because it's something so different for him, right? And it's not, you know, he can't accept that. So it's amazing how they all play off each other. I just thought, like, the acting was incredible, and there's the sound design too. Something is like with him going deaf, you know, when Ruben's like losing his hearing, it's coming on so so quickly, and then we can hear it through his ears, how he can barely make out any words. Goes to a pharmacy in desperation to come look for a diagnosis, and then goes to that to the doctor who tells him about this expensive surgery. So then he has that in the back of his mind this the whole time, even when he's like rehabilitating himself really or learning how to be deaf. He still pines for that, and and you can see it in his face and his actions. And I think, yeah, that was really well done.
I was gonna say the sound designers are really kind of like the fourth stars in the movie, and I want to look them up because I think they deserve they deserve special mention. Because yeah, the movie is really immersive in terms of, I don't want to say the deaf experience, but in terms of like giving you auditory an auditory sense. I saw one comment where somebody said the sound in this movie is in 3D, or the Sound of Metal is 3D for the ears. And I thought that's a really great way to sum up the movie, because it does really immerse you in, because he's not 100% deaf when he loses his hearing. He retains about 20%, and it's, you have to kind of really understand what he's going through. However, it's a visual medium, so you're not reading narration descriptions. So the sound design has to do a lot of really hard work to show you how garbled is what he's hearing is. Not just the noise and the sounds of everyday life, but there are a couple of really great scenes. There's the one where he's with a little boy who's deaf, and they're on the playground, and he's sitting at the bottom of a metal slide, and he starts tapping on it. And the little boy he has his hands on the slide because he can feel the vibrations from the tapping. And even though you can't feel the you kind of get a sense of that. And it's a really cute, really nice little scene. And the other thing that the director does, whose name I will mention, Darius Marder, another really great thing he does is, until Ruben learns sign language, you do not get subtitles for what everybody else is saying in sign language.
Yeah.
And that also like really dips you and makes it helps you identify with Ruben's sort of feeling of like being thrown into the deep end of this new world with its new language and its new sensations. And it's all around just the sound design and just like even just the general design and things with the subtitles and things. It is a really incredible technical job that is done to really sell the sensation of deafness or of hearing impairedness. And I looked them up in IMDb. Maria Carolina Santana Carballo Gramco are the sound editors. Philip Blatt is the production sound mixer, and Nicholas Becker is the supervising sound editor. So those are probably the people most responsible for creating that really great sound design. And I don't usually get really really engaged with the sound mixing categories at the Oscars, but I will be rooting for them this year for sure.
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah, kudos to them. And like you're saying, it's quite the immersive experience. And that is a good sort of analogy, sort of saying it's 3D for the ears. And you definitely feel that. And that's how you can really get into that character and feel what he's feeling, you know, in sort of, it's almost like a first person sort of way, right? You're feeling what he's going through, and then it takes you out of there too, so then you can hear. Like there's a really interesting scene where Lou is back home with her father in Paris, and he's a musician too, and they're singing a song together, and you can hear it from the crowd's perspective, and you can hear how beautiful the song is, and then you hear it from Ruben's perspective, because he's there, he's reunited with her, and he's like, and it's just so distorted, and there so many issues, so now he can't something that was, you know, such a big part of his life that he loved music, now is just, it's not the same. And but he's trying to, you know, trying to make changes to make it better, but it makes it worse, makes the distortion worse. And like you said, that scene in the playground with the child at the addiction center there, where they're pounding on the slide, and they can hear the vibrations. It's like that's sort of like music for him now, and he's enjoying it. He loves it, right? And when he's with the class and he's teaching them how to drum, he loves that too, with the deaf students. So it's like he can't fully accept it, because it's not the same as what he had before, you know. And it's unfortunate, right? But at the same time, you can understand. You can understand what he's going through.
Yeah, it's... The journey is interesting. Just to attach what you were saying about the ending where he gets the cochlear implants. It, from what I understand, too, and the movie partially deals with this, that, you know, it takes a couple of weeks to adjust them, I guess, to sort of refine how they work so that you can start hearing sounds properly. And of course, he doesn't wait for that. He doesn't wait the requisite, you know, couple of weeks to kind of get all that refined. The first possible opportunity, he hops on a plane. And I can't imagine that's very good if you're in the process of trying to adjust to a new hearing implant. Just, you know, the experience of being on a plane myself, know that there's this constant rush of noise. So that can't be particularly healthy for your ears anyway. The other thing too, from what I understand, music, the cochlear implant doesn't necessarily always work with music, especially live music. So, I mean, either way, he's, I'm not saying cochlear implants are a snake oil cure. They're not. They help a lot of people here, and they do a very good job on it. But I mean, in a sense of the things he's trying to accomplish, he is kind of buying a snake oil cure, because he thinks like, boom, I'll get this. I'll get it, you know, get the procedure done, and I'll be whipped back right into my normal life. I'll slide right in. And the reality of the situation is that even with the cochlear implants, that's not necessarily possible. And the movie reflects that fairly accurately, just, you know, because people with those earplants don't always necessarily get the full range of hearing they used to experience back. Again, that's not to say that the technology isn't sound. And if that is something people, a procedure people get, but, you know, by all means. But just, you know, again, it's another example in the film that he's chasing something that he essentially loses in the first 5 minutes of the movie when he has that sudden hearing loss. It's, he can never get it back, and it's not about him so much as coming to terms with deafness. It's about to revisit what we were saying at the beginning. It's about him coming to terms with how things change, and you can't lean on things as a crutch, whether that's heroin, whether that's your heavy metal career. I guess deafness is a metaphor as well as being an actual thing that this guy is experiencing.
Yeah. Well, like when he first goes to the doctor, he says, okay, you have to reduce all noise right now, you know, and then we'll reevaluate you. And then he goes back and does another gig.
Right back to work.
Yeah. He does another heavy metal gig drumming. And then he feels then he can't hear, and he freaks out and leaves the stage, and Lou leaves too to come after him and finds out what's going on. And like you're saying near the end there, where he goes to Paris, it's like with the cochlear implants, he's like, seems fine for one-on-one conversations, and it's almost like, okay, he can hear all right now. It's not he's back. Yeah. And then there's a crowd, and then there's the party, right? With all that side noise you have at a party, right? And then he's like, he can't concentrate. It's just distorted. And then music, it's the same thing. So it's like, yeah, he thought he had like sort of the perfect cure, be able to just go back to the way things were. And yeah, and it shows like a theme, and it's just dealing with change and sort of like abrupt change. And what do you do, you know? And how do you come to terms with it? And definitely he's a sympathetic character, and you can understand that. And it's interesting with his interactions with Joe at the rehabilitation center there. He's always like, Joe is just so disappointed at that point when he comes back with the operation. He's just like, he's like, you know, and he said, you're like talking like an addict now. Cause he's right. Like, I get this in here. I'm fine. I'm going to be good. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. He's like, you know, you're talking like an addict right now. And
yeah, that's another great Joe line. Yeah.
Yeah. He's so disappointed. And it's just like, it's just, you know, it's tough for him because, you know, he might see himself a bit in the Ruben character, you know, because he was really into music too before that happened to him. He said he was listening to music in Vietnam when the bomb went off. So
right, yeah, yeah.
It's just a tough situation in general, and you know. You're looking for a happy, cheery movie or an escapist movie, I probably wouldn't pick this one. But
I don't know. I don't feel like it's especially. I didn't walk away feeling down from watching it. I wouldn't necessarily say it's a crowd pleaser either.
Yeah.
But
worth watching for sure.
It's absolutely 100% worth watching. I was struck by a review that I was reading where, you know, somebody said it doesn't romanticize deafness, which is what a lot of like movies like this would try to do. It's like, isn't it great that you're deaf? Which it's a weird way to phrase it. But I mean, this isn't like a Helen Keller story either. This is just a bit like, you know, people making, you know, getting through, finding new ways to live, embracing a new life. And you see that for a while in the movie. And this is what one of the questions the movie leaves you with is like, was there a certain point where Ruben was okay with this new world he was living in? Because you see him interact with the other people who are staying at the community. You see him in the classroom with the kids. There's this really great scene where he and another patient at the community are, I guess, maybe there's this game they're playing where they do the alphabet in American Sign Language, and they race to see who can do it first, who can finish first going through the alphabet, and he wins one round, and he's so elated, he's high-fiving, and it's, you think, oh, maybe Ruben will be okay. And then there's this scene, as you said, where Joe offers him a chance to stay at the community as kind of a staffer, and I guess at this point it kind of hits him like, oh my god, this is my life now. Where maybe he forgot in, you know, that montage before that where he's like getting used to things and feeling a part of something else. And here Joe is basically saying, okay, now this is your life and you're not going back to your old one, even though he might have forgotten for a minute that was the end goal. And at that point he starts, you know, going through the old Gulfstream and selling the mixing board and selling his equipment and eventually selling the Airstream itself. And it's kind of sad and self-defeating in a way that, you know, as soon as he unconsciously makes a home for himself and then consciously sabotages it by chasing his old life. So I mean, basically, recklessly, he sells everything he has to get the implants, the cochlear implants, then loses everything he had gained, everything else he had gained in the process. I feel like we're steering back into the this is movie is a downer territory.
No, yeah. It's just it's just, you know, I'm a fan, like, you know, there's a lot of movies that are made in the 70s, you know. You ever watch, you know, the new Hollywood, they always have like an ending that was like sad or ambiguous, or, you know, even like the most popular ones, like the Godfather movies, like those definitely do not have happy endings. And this is, I think, of that ilk. It's just so about the characters and what they're going through. And I really love the way it ends too, where he's sort of enjoying, Ruben's enjoying a moment of stillness. And I saw a quote from an interview with Paul Racy about, well, do you think Ruben comes back to Joe? Does he come back to the shelter? And Paul Racy's like, I don't know. And Paul Racy's like, I hope not. I don't know. And he's just saying that in a standard sort of like happy ending Hollywood movie, he would come back. He'd start dating the school teacher, and that would be the end of the film. And he's like, thank God it's not like that. You know, it's not that sort of contrived sort of happiness at the end. And, you know, I think the ambiguity does a lot for it, and just ending it that way. And, you know, I'm somebody who, yeah, definitely gets satisfied, like, learning more about characters, delving deeper into, like, experiences and, you know, whether they are, you know, life-affirming and happy all the time, or if they do go towards more of the darker side, or even just more of the sort of harsh reality side. And it's what I really like with this, and how they, and like you said, it's not, this film's not without humor. There's so many great moments. Even the Joe characters, you know, just got this way about him, a real positive vibe about him throughout. So, you know, definitely something I would recommend for sure.
It's interesting to hear your comparison to kind of like those 70s movies, because it there's not a feeling in the film that this was not to say that they weren't using modern techniques, because I mean certainly the way the sound design was designed, you know, that would take like very careful tunage. That's not something you could kind of do in camera, but there's really nothing to the film that is particularly stylish, and I mean that in the best possible way. There's a kind of very documentary cinema verite feel to watching everything. It's not even just like that there's a lot of handheld stuff, because there is some handheld stuff in that too, but it does feel very, there's something very naturalistic to the way it was made. And I think it would probably fit nicely in that oeuvre. It is a very character driven piece. And like I said, there are times when it makes it sound like a downer. I never felt down watching it. I felt like this was a kind of a very real story about somebody struggling with a very unique, new and different circumstance. And you feel great when they're able to rise above, and you feel bad whenever they fall back into bad habits. And it leaves you in a place where you don't know where the character is going next, but you feel very hopeful for them that they have come to terms with everything and are prepared to move on with their lives. And I guess we'll have to just wait and see what happens to Ruben in Sound of Metal 2. I doubt we'll ever see a Sound of Metal 2. But
yeah, that would kind of defeat the purpose. That would go against... I don't think Paul Racy with that interview, I don't think he'd be signing up for it, but maybe they could get somebody else, you know.
Sound of Metal 2, The Return of Paul Racy. We'll have to leave that there. And Tim, if people want to talk to you some more about movies or anything or whatever else you're up to, where can people find you on the internet?
On the internet, Flash in the Deadpan on all the social media if you want to interact with me.
And that's it for this week's show. We hope you liked it as always. And if you want to listen to it again, you can find it on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. You can download it from the Guelph Politicast channel every Friday at Podbean or through your favorite podcast app at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. And speaking of that Spotify app, you can find the playlist for most of the music you hear on end credits.
Just open up Spotify and search for End Credits on CFRU and click play. You can also find us on social media on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show or on Twitter at End Credits Radio. I will be back tomorrow at 5 p.m. for news and politics on open source as Guelph with my co-host there, Scotty Hertz. In the meantime, I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson. You can find my news and politics site at guelphpolitico.ca. And you can find my writing about horror movies over at Nightmare on Film Street at nofspodcast.com. Stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio. We will be back next Wednesday at 3 p.m. for more End Credits, and we will see you then.